I just want to introduce the first set. Shalom Aleichem, guys. Pleasure to be here. My name is Eddie Reichman, and I have the opportunity to talk about one particular topic in the world of medical halacha today, the world of genetics. Since I don't have the opportunity to teach the full semester, I just want to go around the room and just everybody introduce themselves quickly. Say your name, what year you are here, and what you guys are interested in. Let's start with the letter right here.
I'm a freshman. This is my first year, and I'm interested in becoming a doctor.
Great.
Hi, I'm Zin. Dentistry, this is my second year.
Terry and
Ali's.
Good, good. Send him our regards, yeah.
It's my first year, dentistry.
Excellent.
Justin Wiener, first semester.
Jeremy Bunefeld, again. My last semester here, I'm going for a position assistant.
Great. Right.
Yeah. Jerobieski, this is my first year. Pre-med.
Amy Needle, my second in the day. What was your question? Pre-med.
Excellent.
Benji Kurtz, my second year. I'm going to Barstow.
Benjamin Penn, second in a bit, and TA.
Excellent. So you're all basically health-related fields. This is a required course for going into health-related fields. Is that the story?
Yeah.
Very good. Okay, call it kavod. And you coordinated the course this year.
Yeah.
Very good. I will tell you guys. I mean, that you're very fortunate. First of all, you're fortunate that you have the opportunity to take a course like this. You're also fortunate because the people teaching this course, I think I know everybody teaching this course, maybe present company excluded, are really amazing, amazing people. Rabbi Dr. Glatt is an amazing fellow. I'm not going to tell you all the names, but you know all the names of the people you've had, and they really are exceptional people. So you're very fortunate to have had exposure to these people who are really the big names in the field of medical halacha and the relationship of science and medicine and halacha in the world today. So kol hakavod to you, kol hakavod to all the people that have the opportunity to teach you. So like I said, we're going to talk about one particular topic today. You've covered, just remind me the topics that you guys have covered. If you don't... Did you say transgender?
Yeah. That's a way to start.
Shabbos,
transport,
the teats of the pet, very good.
Contraception.
Good stuff, good stuff.
Organ donation.
Organ donation, very good. End of life, euthanasia,
Stavos,
Nagia.
All that can't
be formed. Yichud issues, Shabbos, you did Shabbos. Shabbos, so we're towards the end, right? How many more? Not too many more, right? Wait, so this one you said?
This is 11.
Okay, fantastic. So if you guys have any questions about any of the topics that you've covered, you can ask me after class, obviously. But because there's a lot of issues that have come up, and I'm happy to discuss any of the issues that you've already covered. So we're going to cover today the world of genetics and halacha. Did you do infertility, by the way?
Yeah.
So who did the... Do you remember who did
it? It was
Ricky Weiss.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Great. Okay, fantastic. Okay, so we're going to interface a little bit with infertility today. As you can well imagine, you do need genetics for reproduction. But when we start with genetics, first of all, genetics is really the basis of everything that we are. And in a certain sense, the human genome is really... very similar to the Sefer Torah. It's comprised of many different letters, letters which require explanation, letters which are a code and have to be understood through a complex process. And in fact, if one letter of the Sefer Torah is missing, Sefer Torah is puzzle. Same thing, if one base pair, literally one letter, of the hundreds of thousands and millions of letters of the DNA is missing, can literally wreak havoc on a human being and cause fatalities, or if not fatalities, very severe disabilities. it's really quite extraordinary. But in addition to that, there's some other aspects of the relationship between DNA and the Torah. This illustration I just found this year, and I found it one of the most amazing illustrations. And to me, it represents reciprocal aspects of the relationship of Torah and the human being. First of all, HaKadosh Baruch Hu istakel b'raisa b'ra alma. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu used the sacred Torah, used the Torah to create the world. So the world is, the Torah is in essence the DNA of the world, is the blueprint of the world. But the other aspect is that Torah is integral in our DNA. The Torah is a part of our DNA. And this is also reflected in this illustration. And what makes it interesting also is that the DNA can sometimes have variable expression. So while every person in this room has innate aspects of Torah in their DNA, some people express it differently, some people express it differently in the course of their lives, some people express more, some people express less, very much like the DNA itself. Some have even argued that the very morphology, the very shape of the chromosomes is similar to the aleph base. So this is a chromosome font. I don't know if you guys have this in your laptop, you probably don't. This is an aleph, a bays, a gimel, a dalet. Obviously it's from left to right as opposed to right to left. Let's see if this thing is working from this distance. So what we're gonna do today, for our outlined lectures as follows. We're gonna talk about genetics and Chazal. So genetics possibly in the Chumash, genetics in the Gemara. Obviously it's going to be anachronistic to some extent, but you'll see there's some fascinating hints or allusions to it. We're going to talk about the impact of genetics on the Jewish family, which is halacha l'maisa, why it's important for you guys to know genetics and the impact on the family, which is immense, and it's becoming more immense every day. That's why it's essential for you to know this. We're going to discuss genetics, about the definition of a Jew, and if we have time, we'll talk about the genetics of the Kohen. So here's an angel speaking to Kosh Baruch, he says, God, the human genome code has been unraveled. So Hashem says, those darn hackers, now I have to change the password. So let's talk about a little bit allusions to the concept of genetics in Chazal or in the Chumash. So one of those, and this was mentioned by Rabbi Jonathan Sachs, who developed this idea very beautifully, that the very first example of cloning we actually have by Avram and Yitzchak. It says, Ela told us Yitzchak ben Avram, Avram holidus Yitzchak, and you guys are, I'm sure, familiar with the Rashi. Avram holidus Yitzchak, Ayideh Shekasav, Akasav Yitzchak ben Avram, Huzkak Loma, Avram holidus Yitzchak. Why does it say the repetition? And so it says that there are people, Avram and Sarah were infertile for many years. Then they go to Abimelech, and very shortly after they spend time at Abimelech, all of a sudden Sarah becomes pregnant. So there were people who said, maybe she didn't get pregnant from Avram, maybe she got pregnant from Abimelech. So what did HaKadosh Baruch Hu do? HaKadosh Baruch Hu made the physical appearance of Yitzchak identical to the physical appearance of Avram. So in a sense, it's the first example of human cloning. They're the same. They're identical. And what happened? So it started out okay, but when Yitzchak started getting older, things got a little confusing. When people came to visit Avram and they saw Yitzchak, they started to deal with Yitzchak. When people started to look for Yitzchak, they saw Avram, they couldn't figure it out. So Avram petitioned HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and this is the Chazal where it says, Avram zakein baba yamin v'ashem be'rachas Avram b'kol. What does Gemara Sanhedrin say on this pasuk? Ad Avraham lo hayazikna. Called the Chazi la Avram Amar HaYitzchak, called the Chazi Yitzchak Amar HaYavram. Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu made them identical, they were interchangeable and confused all the time. So HaKadosh Avraham requested that he begin to age. And that's why it says Avram Zakin Baba Yamim. So what does that mean before this, according to Chazal? So it doesn't mean that people didn't chronologically age. Of course, with the passage of time, they age. But it means they didn't physiologically age. They would live however long they would live, then they would die, but the face wouldn't get older. So with Abraham, it was the development of Zikna, and Zikna meant that he looked older, even though they had the same initial facial features, because Abraham was so many years, 100 years older than his son, he looked older than his son, and he could differentiate. So it's an interesting observation that perhaps the first experiment of cloning, which, at least in this scenario, perhaps didn't go so well. Another aspect of genetics, which is, according to some, you will find in the Torah, is the relationship between Yaakov and Esav in utero. An interesting question, which I suspect you never thought of, right? It says that Yisrael Tzitzu HaBonim B'Kirba, the Torah became Lomazah Anofi L'Telach L'Rosh HaShem. So what is Yisrael Tzitzu, what is a simple pshat of Yisrael Tzitzu HaBonim B'Kirba, which you guys learned in grade school, Yisrael Tzitzu HaBonim B'Kirba? They're fighting, right? So this is something you probably never thought of, but you know, if they are two separate fetuses in two separate amniotic sacs, it's not so easy for them to fight with each other, right? Although, you know, so the question is, did they just kick when they, you know, Yaakov kicked when they went to a shul, and Esav kicked when they went to a church, or did they actually fight with each other? So some have actually suggested that that they were identical twins. Now you may ask me, how is it possible that they're identical twins? Yeah, one was hairy, one was not, one was you know, red hair, one was whatever, one was more physically nourished, and one was meek and pale. So some have suggested that this is a case of what's called twin-to-twin transfusion. Now what is twin-to-twin transfusion? And unfortunately, I don't have the video, but it's a remarkable video of watching these two twins actually look like they're fighting each other. It looks like they're jabbing, punching each other. It's a twin-to-twin, twin-to-twin transfusion. They're twins, they're identical twins, or at least fraternal twins, and there is a transfusion of blood, or one child gets preferential circulation over the other. So the mother's circulation enters into the womb, but sometimes one of the babies will get more circulation than the other. When that happens, that child who gets the preferential circulation is stronger, is bigger, is plumper, is more nourished, and the one who gets the less circulation is meek, and is pale, etc. So that could explain the differential between Yaakov and Esav on birth. Of course, it doesn't explain that differential later in life, because they should equal out, and they should become more identical if they, in fact, were identical twins or not. And someone has suggested that might depend on the shoresh of the word by Yisrotzitzu. If the shoresh is rots, like running, then in theory they can be each in their own amniotic sac, but if it's rotsats, which is fighting, then they would have to be monoamniotic. So someone has written on this. This is an article, Biblical Twins in Obstetrics and Gynecology, in the year 1998. By the way, the slides, happy to make the slides available to you guys for your general interest. Another classic one, which, what's your first name again, Mordechai?
Mordechai,
sorry to keep forgetting. Which Mordechai says that one of your genetics teachers or biology teachers asked you, is Yaakov and the sheep of Lavan. What are you guys laughing
about? Classic. It's a classic question. That's
right. It's a classic question. So you find it in biology. Right. So it's a classic dominant recessive. And in fact, you know, some people have even made you know, genetic charts based on that. And there's a there's an article in the tradition many years ago, Jacob's Cattle and Modern Genetics, a scientific approach, for those of you who are interested in a more detailed approach on this. There is also another perspective on this, which I'm just going to mention briefly, won't get into the detail, but you'll find it expressed in many areas of Chazal and in many other cultures as well, is that what did the Yaakov do in order to make the sheep mate and to produce certain types of characteristics.
We'll look at rods.
Right, so the rods had the same image for whatever it was that he wanted to produce. So there is this notion called maternal imprinting, which is a notion which dates back to antiquity. And that notion, according to that notion, when either animals or human beings are mating, if in the process of mating there's an image imprinted on the woman, that image will imprint on the fetus. So that's why, I don't know if you guys are familiar with this Minhag, pregnant women don't go to a zoo. Ever hear that Minhag? So this, and all these things, pregnant women stay away from crazy images because of this old notion that these images will be imprinted on the fetus during the course of pregnancy. And there's a Gemara which talks about, I think it was Rabbi Yehuda and one of the emperors at the time, whose wife had a child that was dark-skinned, and he thought that she was an adulteress, and he asks, are there any dark statues in the palace? And he said, yes, there are. So he defended her and said, well, maybe that's what imprinted on her fetus, etc., etc. So this notion has been like an old notion, and this you will find sometimes in Rishonim also. So these are sort of very tenuous connections to genetics in the Torah. But in the Gemara, you have a passage which has a more direct relationship to genetics. And this is a passage talking about Hilchos Mila. It's a passage that comes from Yevamos. Netanya Mala HaRishon Umeis, Sheni Umeis, Shlishi Lo Tomo. Divrei Rebbe. Rishon Mila Omer Shlishi Tomo. Revi Lo Tomo. So what's the case here? The case is, the halachic discussion actually is a halachic discussion about chazaka, which we're not going to talk about so much in detail now, that'll be for your Gemara shears. But Mala HaRishon Umeis, if a family had a child who died from Mila, and then they had another child who died from Mila, and the assumption here is that the cause of death was uncontrolled bleeding or exsanguination. Should they mal the third child? And if they have a third child who dies, should they mal the fourth child? So if you're looking at this, I mean, obviously, you see the answer. what can this possibly remind you of in the 21st century of uncontrolled bleeding? So one thing that we know about that causes uncontrolled bleeding is the disease called hemophilia. Hemophilia is a genetic disease, which is an X-linked disease, which means it's carried on the X chromosome. And it's transmitted to male children. Now, females will not exhibit hemophilia because they'll have another normal gene on the other X chromosome. But males who are XY, if that defective gene is on the Y chromosome, right, then it'll be expressed. So this is, on the X, they only have a Y chromosome, so they don't have a gene to counter it. So if they have a defective gene on that X chromosome, their other chromosome is a Y chromosome, so they're going to end up expressing the disease. So Chazal talked about this as a disease which is transmitted from the mother. And we're not going to get into all the details. There's lots of interesting, and it's not always consistent, to be perfectly honest. But some people look to this makor as the very first source of hemophilia in any literature. So hemophilia wasn't described in the medical literature until thousands of years after the Gemara. But some people turn to this saying that this is a marker for hemophilia. And it even says, by the way, so that's one couple. But let's say you have multiple sisters. Masav arba achios v'tzipore. Shemal rishon meis sheni meis shlishi meis. You have three sisters in three separate marriages. And each one of the sisters, sister one had a child that died of Mila, sister two had a child that died of Mila, should the third sister or fourth sister mala her child? So that's a sensitivity, or at least appreciation of the fact that there is something that's being transmitted through the family. To say genetics is obviously anachronistic, but it's a sensitivity of transmission of disease, of familial transmission of disease. This is just the transmission of hemophilia. And furthermore, in that same daf in the Yevamos, it says the following. It says, Lo yisa adam isha, lo mi mishpachas nichvin, ve lo mi mishpachas mitzorayim, ve hu dischazik klasazimne. So Gemara says, you shouldn't marry a woman from a family of nichvin and a family of mitzorayim. Now, I suspect mitzorayim, you know what a mitzorah is, right? Do you know what nichvin is? Nichvin is seizures, seizure disorder. Now, seizure disorder generally isn't hereditary. There are hereditary forms of seizure disorder, but they perceived it as being a hereditary condition at this time. So in antiquity, the seizure disorder was thought to be hereditary. Lo mishpach is mitzorin. So what's mitzorah? Translate it over for me.
Leper.
What is leprosy? You guys ever seen a case of leprosy?
On TV.
So I've seen a case of leprosy. I've seen a number of cases of leprosy. Actually, I spent in the election in South Africa. They had a whole leper clinic. So I will tell you that tsaras is not leprosy. And I'll explain to you why it is that it's commonly held belief that tsaras is leprosy. Tsaras is... it's a skin disease, right? It's a skin disease found in the humans, on the house, and on the clothing. Tsaras was translated leprosy for the following reason. When the Torah was translated into Greek, called the Targum HaShivim, or in Greek, the Septuaginta, the Septuagint. Septua is like septuagenarian, septa 7, 70. It was translated, and according to Chazal, there were 70 Gdolim that got into 70 separate rooms, and they translated the Torah into Greek. And the miracle was that they translated identical, all of them translated identically, with variations. Because there are certain things that translated would be misunderstood by the Goyim. So they have to make actual changes in the Torah so it wouldn't be misunderstood by the Goyim. So they translated it. When they translated it, they translated Tsaras as lepros, which in Greek just means skin disease or skin condition. Later on in history, there was a disease called leprosy with a capital L, which is based on the same etymology, which is associated with this disease that we now know today called leprosy, has nothing to do with tsaras, nothing. There have been thousands and thousands of pages over the centuries that have been written about the association of tsaras and leprosy. It is not leprosy. Leprosy doesn't affect clothes, leprosy doesn't affect houses. What is tsaras then? Do we know what tsaras is today? So some people say it might be some fungal condition, whatever the case may be. Not so relevant. But here what you find is a sensitivity to the fact that disease can be transmitted to families. Now, this is an interesting question, by the way. You know, translated to Bismanazel, does that mean you shouldn't? What is this? Is this a suggestion? Is this a mitzvah? Is it to marry someone who comes from one of these kinds of families who has disease in the family? So this was codified in the Shulchan Aruch, by the way. Lo yisa adam isha lo mishpachas nichven v'lo mishpachas mitzrayim. And the general assumption is that it's not a chiyuv or an iser to marry someone from these families, but it's an eitz tova. Now let's talk about the impact of genetics on the modern Jewish family and bring us up to the 20th and the 21st century. So the first disease that was identified in the modern era to have a genetic basis was a disease called Tay-Sachs. How many of you guys here are familiar with the disease of Tay-Sachs? How many of you have seen a case of Tay-Sachs?
On TV?
It's always on TV. So what we're going to realize is why it is that you guys have never seen Tay-Sachs. Now, if I would have been teaching this class 34 years ago, and I would have asked how many people have seen a case of Tay-Sachs or know about a case of Tay-Sachs, all the hands would have gone up. There were actually wards in hospitals in New York which were Tay-Sachs wards filled with children. Now, Tay-Sachs is a disease that afflicts particularly the Ashkenazi Jewish community. It's a recessive gene transmission disease, which means that both the mother and the father have to be carriers for the disease, and this is basic genetics, which I don't need to remind you guys, that if they each are carriers for a recessive gene, there's a 1 in 4 chance that each child will have this particular disease. So it was just now, in this period of time, where they identified that there was a specific genetic cause. Why is it called Tay-Sachs? So there's two people that were involved independently to identify different defects in these children. So one was a Dr. Tay, this is Warren Tay, who noticed a very unique eye finding, which he reported in the Ophthalmological Society in the late 1800s. And the other, this is called a cherry red spot, which you can find in a child with Tay-Sachs. It's a very distinctive finding. The only way you can see that is looking literally into the back of the eye with a special instrument, which your doctor sometimes, when you go to the doctor, and they tell you to look straight ahead, and they take this thing, and they look in the back of your eye. This is your retina. This is what they would normally see. This is a cherry red spot that you'd find, which is a unique pathological finding in a child with Tay-Sachs disease. And the other person was a doctor, Bernie Sachs, who published the neurological findings of these particular children, and they realized they were talking about the same population. So the Journal of Nervous and Mental Disease, also in the late 1800s. So they called it Tay-Sachs disease. Unfortunately, it's an extremely tragic disease. These children would look normal at birth till about 3-4 years old, and then they'd start to have serious decline of the nervous system and mental capacity, and it's almost 100% fatality. It's a terrible disease. So when they found the gene associated with it in the 1960s, and this gene is responsible for producing an enzyme called hexosaminidase. So there's a hexosaminidase deficiency for these children. So they were able to test for this disease back in the 1960s, and this disease had very significant impacts, as we'll see as we go through our cases now. So let's, given that history, sorry, this thing is a little. So what we're going to do for the rest of the time is the following. I'm going to share with you the history of a fictional family. And through this fictional family, we'll approach the kinds of issues that many of us will approach during the course of our lifetimes, and are issues which are found in the modern world and very relevant for the Jewish community. So we'll start with a young couple. You guys in your late teens, early 20s. So let's say you have a young couple. Let's say Avraham and Sarah. Right? So Avraham and Sarah in their early 20s, and they get engaged. And their parents tell them, you're engaged, why don't you guys go get genetic testing? So they say, what's genetic testing? What are we testing for? So this is their first encounter with the entire world of genetics in the 21st century. And what, in fact, can you be testing for? And should you be tested for? Or should you be doing testing at all? And what's the purpose of doing this testing? So when you identify, and this, yes, go ahead.
I'm going to answer your question.
Yeah, you can ask, go ahead.
So you don't bring a child into this world that has deformities?
So do you bring a child into this world that has deformities? So I believe it was Yeshaya said to Chizkiah. Chizkiah knew that he was going to have Menashe as a grandchild. Menashe was literally the worst king in the history of Klal Yisrael. So he decided not to have children. So Yeshaya came to him and said, you're going to die. So he said, why am I going to die? He goes, you should have been the kind of mitzvah pervu. So he said, why am I the kind of mitzvah pervu? Because I knew I was going to have Menashe. So he said, I forget the exact lashon, but he said, basically, it's not your business. This is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's business. You do what you're supposed to do, HaKadosh Baruch Hu does what he's supposed to do. So even though he knew, and everybody knew, that he was going to have Menashe.
Now it is, we'll know of birth.
Right, so that's a question. Now that you know, should you prevent the birth of these children? And this is an excellent question. We'll see that even though Yeshaya said to Chizkiah that response, how does that translate into the modern era? So the question was asked of Moshe. In yesh libdok l'machalas teisex kodim hanesuin. So let me put this into context for you. This is a recessive gene. This recessive gene, if any of you in this room, and it's quite possible that someone in this room has genes, recessive genes for genetic conditions. As an individual with a recessive gene, there's absolutely no impact on you whatsoever. You can lead your entire life with no problems. However, if you marry someone who has that similar recessive gene, there's a 25% chance that you'll produce a child that has whatever condition you carry. So for our illustrations, we're going to use Tay-Sachs disease. So if you marry someone who has Tay-Sachs who's a Tay-Sachs carrier, there's a 1 in 4 chance you'll have a child with Tay-Sachs, and we said it's almost 100% mortality for these children who have Tay-Sachs. So they asked Moshe, when the test became available, should we be testing? Maybe we shouldn't test. Maybe we should say, you know, Tamim Tiyem Hashem Elokecha. Maybe we should say, it's not our domain. Hakadosh Baruch Hu wants us to have a child with Tay-Sachs, then Hakadosh Baruch Hu wants to have a child with Tay-Sachs. So how did he respond? He says, Iyanti bozeh v'zeu ha'yir lan yazayti ka'afi shu miyut katan milodim milodim ka'elu v'shayach lomer al zeh ha'krod v'tamim Tiyem Hashem Elokecha, etc., etc. Mikol makom. Let me just use this. So he says, since it's such an easy test to do, it's literally a blood test. You can go get your test, find out if you're a carrier, find out if the other person is a carrier, and if the other person is a carrier, you just don't go out with them. And that is, in fact, what he responded. That is, in fact, what started one of these extraordinary organizations called Dor Yesharim. Who here is familiar with the Dor Yesharim organization? You guys are all familiar with Dor Yesharim. Did they announce it or PR it here in the school?
Yeah. Yeah.
They came like 2 weeks ago.
They came 2 weeks ago? Perfect. Okay, so the timing is good. So when this started back in the 60s, there was one gene that was tested, one disease that was tested for, and that disease was Tay-Sachs disease. There are now... This is the Ashkenazi Jewish screening panel of Einstein. Actually, this organization probably is no longer, you know, is in the midst of folding, but they test him for 38 genetic diseases. If you go to J-Screen, you go online, it'll probably change over the next weeks or months, they're testing for 100 plus genetic conditions. And not all of them are recessive. Some of them are dominant. And we don't have the time in this forum to discuss all the differences between all the different diseases. But it is exploding. Our knowledge of genetics is exploding today. Our understanding of the human genome is exploding. Our ability to identify genetic causes for diseases is continually expanding. So today it's, you know, then it was one, now it's 100. You know, in 10, 20, 30 years from now, it'll be probably a few hundred diseases that you'll be able to test. And this is that's why it's important for us to keep on top of these things, because we're going to need to understand whether we should be testing or whether we should not be testing. How can one do these kinds of carrier testings today? These are just a few of the organizations: Dor Yesharim, the Program for Jewish Genetic Health, J-Screen. Do you guys know the difference if you test with Dor Yesharim or if you test with these other organizations? Dor Yesharim does not tell you what you have. You guys are all aware of that? Does Dor Yesharim come to campus for you to test?
They did right now.
So they can actually come to campus and you can test here. Now, I will tell you, I'm not advocating one or the other. I'm just sharing with you the differences. There clearly are values to both. Why did Dor Yesharim make this an anonymous test?
So that people... Isn't another shoe over Moshe that says that you should test but you shouldn't know, because the anxiety of people to walk around with what you should know and what you shouldn't know is too much.
So I don't remember if Moshe specifically says that is a fact. That is a fact, yeah.
All the populations that this was targeting didn't say no more about genetics and what that meant, recessive traits, they want to get more anonymous.
So there was a concern that if you were identified as being a carrier, that very simply you would put a stigma on that individual and you probably should do things. So you said that population. Do you consider yourself that population or not?
Are you only started by Samers?
Hasidus, he's not Samer. By the way, Rabbi Eckstein, who started this, who may have even been here, I don't know if he himself was here, He lost four children to Tay-Sachs disease. Four children he lost. Baruch Hashem, he had many more healthy children. And he's the one who started this organization. And when he started it with anonymous testing. Yeah.
You know, did his wife and him have it together?
Yeah.
So why? If you know you have it, why?
So he started having children before they had testing.
Oh, okay.
So he started to, they didn't have the test when they got married.
Like after the second, third, like.
They said we're still going to keep having children. You know, they did not have children. That's a shaila. Is it usher to have children? Is it mutter to have children? Are you still mechuyev to have children? So most posts can say, let's say you already know that you have a genetic condition, and it's a non-testable genetic condition, and your children will have this very severe non-testable genetic condition. Can you continue to have children? Should you continue to have children? Must you continue to have children? So it's not so pashut. So for example, if Zilberstein says he probably have a chiyuv of continued chiyuv of peruvu, but he said if the couple is extraordinarily stressed and tremendous psychological impact, then maybe they don't necessarily have to continue peruvu at that stage.
That's why you should test before,
right? Right. So right, but in this scenario there was no test.
Right.
But that's why it is absolutely essential, and I'm not an advocate for any type of testing, whether open or closed testing, but I'm a very strong advocate for testing. Because it'll save an extraordinary amount of agony and stress if you end up in a situation that you could have simply tested for. And it's just not appropriate, it's not worth it.
Continue the other one questioning about whether two carriers who were already married,
yeah,
need to have children. Is there any reason for them to do PGD or some other thing?
Good, excellent. So Mordechai asked the question about PGD, we'll get to PGD. By the way, Dor Yesharim, they will not tell you your answer, they will not tell you any particular disease that you test for, but they will tell you if two people submit the number that you're not a genetic match. And if they know that you're not a genetic match, they will counsel you to not marry. Very strongly counsel you to not marry, and there are poskim who will counsel you to divorce if you are found to be both carriers for genetic conditions. But I'm telling you that this is the reality. Now, you know, there are other solutions which we'll get to, which is extremely important to know. Yes.
Just like he does Dor Yesharim, she does J-Screen.
Good, excellent question. So here's how it works practically. Dor Yesharim will not divulge that information, never. Not only that, the information Dor Yesharim is never associated with a name. It's only associated with a number. And if you lose the number yourself for your own testing, there's no way for you to get it. None. You're going to have to test yourself again. Now, if your potential spouse, if the person you're interested in, didn't do Dor Yesharim and they did open testing, you have two options. Either she can go do Dor Yesharim, and they may not even test her if she already did open testing. They're particular about that. Or you can do open testing. Now, what's the advantage of doing open testing? The advantage of doing open testing is you have that information. Now, we are all theoretical believers in the value of information, but I will tell you, I'm not 100% convinced that it's the best thing to have this information. I think generally we believe that knowledge is power, and I generally believe that's generally true. But I think the jury's still out in terms of whether Dor Yesharim is best or non-Dor Yesharim is best. But the important thing is that you both test. That's the most important thing. How you test, I really don't care.
But if one half only does open testing and she's fine, why does the other person have to test? Because you said you need...
Right, that's true. If she has none of these...
If she's clear, then you're...
If she's clear, right, that's true. That's a good point. And, by the way, if your parents both do open testing, and they have none of these conditions, then you're clear and all your siblings are clear. So that's part of the advantage of doing open testing, is you save future generations from having to do testing. But,
until new tests are added,
Mordechai hastens to add, there are constantly new tests that are being added. So even if you tested Dor Yesharim 5 years ago, there are new tests that have been added to Dor Yesharim
Do they even tell you, Dor Yesharim, that they have new tests available, or are they still going to tell you?
So I think that Dor Yesharim will tell you. So if you call Dor Yesharim and say, I tested 5 years ago, do I need to retest?
They'll tell you if you should test again.
I believe that they will tell you if you need to retest. Or Dor Yesharim keeps the samples. They might even be able to retest the sample that you have. but I'm not 100% sure about that.
It's been a while since I was tested, but if I remember correctly, DoHRM will not talk to people who are currently dating, but they'll talk, they want you to call before you start dating, so that they don't, one of their things is that they don't want to break up relationships. So if you're
right,
married,
and the truth is, the most effective time to do this is before you date, not before you get engaged, because then it wreaks havoc. Yeah.
Why can't you know what you have?
Right. So you could do open testing and know what you have.
Why can't DoHRM?
That's DoHRM's policy. They're never going to change that policy. That's the way they operate, and they have a reason to operate. And to be perfectly honest, You can suggest reasons why you would not do it, but DoHRM is single-handedly responsible for dropping the Tay-Sachs incidence from up here to almost zero.
Also, if a couple is in a relationship, then they go for testing, they find out that it's not a match, what would make them want to stay in a relationship? They know it's not a match.
Right, so it makes them want to stay in a relationship because they're in love with each other, and they believe that they may not be able to find someone who's as compatible in other ways. They may not be genetically compatible, but they may be compatible, and as we'll see in a few moments, there are other solutions in the 21st century that didn't exist back in the 1960s. Did you have a question?
Yeah, it seems a little counterintuitive that they don't want to break up couples because they're not, it's like doing it, they're just offering advice, like, because they're dating or not, or engaged, like, you have to know this is important. Causes more strife later on. So it seems a little counterintuitive. Does it not do what they're getting to tell them?
I think their point is they're trying to minimize the stress. So by making a policy like that, the objective is they'll get people to test before they date and decrease the stress of these relationships. Because when you've already started to date and you're already involved and then you test and find out they're not compatible, it's just very, very, very complex. And it's not the kind of thing you really want to get into.
So really a shot them before they even give over all the information, they should ask for the two numbers of DoHRM.
Correct.
Right?
That is correct. Before you date, you really should, if you do open testing. So I know a lot of people do open testing and they know. And they'll say, listen, I'm a carrier for this and this, I just want you to know that. You know, if you've tested and you're a carrier, then maybe we shouldn't be going out. And this is not something that's it's really almost, it should be done as part of a reflex, part of a routine, just part of a preliminary questioning before you go out. Don't think about it too much. Don't waste time obsessing about it. It's just a factual thing that you need to check before you go out with somebody that'll save you immense amount of stress for your entire life. So don't minimize the value or importance of this. Yes?
So both parents, I guess, don't have it as a child for sure
will not. Correct. Now, you have to be very cautious. There are cases where people tested, but there are certain mutations that weren't tested for. It's complex. But that is basically true. In the majority of cases, if both parents test and they are not carriers for Tay-Sachs, then none of their children would be carriers for this. By the way, DoHRM does not tell you if you are a carrier. So they'll just say you're genetically compatible. So one could be a carrier. So the fact that DoHRM says it's okay to marry doesn't mean that your kids won't get the gene. All it means is that you are not both carriers. But one of you could be a carrier who could then transmit it to the subsequent progeny. You follow me on that one?
Yeah, it's just, I don't like that system.
Right, so you don't have to go with that system. No one's forcing you to go with that system by
any means. That's why there are other systems.
That's why there are other systems.
Something like the first one.
Now, J Screen came to YU. YU used to offer, I'm involved with the Medical Ethics Society at YU, so every year there's a genetic screening that used to be offered by Einstein and NYU, and they had open and closed, and et cetera. Last year we did just J-Screen. We had over 1,000 people signed up for screening that last year. Over 1,000 people, including the Rebaim. This is the Program for Jewish Genetic Health. This is Einstein's program.
With Einstein itself.
Einstein itself, yeah, but I think
I think
it's being phased out. Open. The only closed program is DoHRM. All medical centers are 100% open. No half of me is going to be closed. Yeah, this is that one of your program from last year. So on to our next topic. So following our couple, our fictional couple, Avram and Sarah. So Avram and Sarah listen to their parents and they go and test. they find out they're both carriers for the disease. And we said this is a complex scenario. They are strongly encouraged to break off the engagement, but they decide not to. They said, we love each other, we're going ahead. They go ahead with the marriage. It's now a year later, and Sarah is pregnant. And Sarah's thinking, now I have to deal with the consequences of that decision. She doesn't know if the child she's carrying in her has Tay-Sachs or doesn't have Tay-Sachs. What are your medical options? What are your halachic options? So the medical options are as follows. This is just in Hebrew, so you guys don't know how your medical Hebrew is. But what are your medical options? So how are you going to find out if the baby that she's carrying has Tay-Sachs or not? The only way you can do that is to get tissue from the fetus or from the amniotic fluid or from the chorionic villus around the baby. How do you do that?
Amniocentesis.
So you do what's called amniocentesis. So amnio is the amniotic fluid around the baby. Centesis is, you know, putting a needle in it. So you literally put a needle into the fluid around the baby. There's another method, just for the sake of completeness, called chorionic villus sampling. Same basic concept. You get tissue from which you can extract the genetics and determine. Now, we are talking about Tay-Sachs, but you can determine anything that's genetically determinable from these tissues, not just the Tay-Sachs. So the question is, are you allowed to do those procedures or not? And let's say you do that procedure and you find out that the child has Tay-Sachs, then what do?
First
40 days. So have you guys discussed the issue of abortion in any other of your lectures, either here or other lectures? So we're not going to discuss the whole study of abortion. It's a very complex study, but we'll discuss it superficially today. So they asked Moshe Feinstein, who said you should test, but they asked Moshe Feinstein, should you do chorionic, should you do amniocentesis? Yimoto lizo ubar yimuchola. Can you do an amniocentesis? They asked her, Moshe. So Moshe answered in the following way, and it's entirely based on his sheet of abortion. So according to Moshe, his sheet of abortion is that it's not ritzicha mamish, because you're not chayv misa and based in, but it's ke'en ritzicha for a whole host of reasons. So based on his extreme and the machmir sheet of abortion, he said, you can't abort the baby under any circumstances for a fetal indication, which means if no matter what the defect in the fetus is, you cannot perform an abortion because according to him, it's gain receipt. Furthermore, the procedure itself can sometimes induce a miscarriage. So when you put a needle into the abdomen, sometimes you're going to cause a miscarriage of the baby, which obviously, and it could be a healthy baby. So he said you shouldn't even do the amniocentesis. Forget about it. But the other polar extreme was that Tzitz Eliezer, and there are shittas in between, that Tzitz Eliezer held that the iser of abortion was not ritzicha, but was chavala. And as a result, he said that there's serious stress to the mother, and obviously the potential, the extraordinary impact on the fetus, then it would be permitted under certain circumstances to perform an abortion. He said the abortion could even be done up to the 7th month. Gestation, which is pretty radical. So, they got to decide. I'm sorry?
Sorry, in what case is it talking about?
Tay-Sachs. Since Eliezer was Matir in Tay-Sachs.
For the 7th month of abort?
Yeah.
Why 7th month?
I'm sorry?
Why the 7th month?
So, 7th month.
Is that viable?
Yeah. It's probably was on the cusp of viability. Right. So, he might actually, if he were alive today, he might change it. The viability is different than all that. So this couple, they got psak that it's mutter for them to undergo amniocentesis. Avram and Sarah underwent the amniocentesis, and Baruch Hashem, they had a healthy baby. The baby was not afflicted with Tay-Sachs. Now they want to have another child, and someone mentions, and they don't want to go through the same agony of deciding amniocentesis, no amniocentesis, abortion, not abortion. And this is what the Mordechai is referring to, and someone shares with them that there is a new technology that's available. This technology is called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. How many people here have heard of the PGD or pre-implantation genetic diagnosis? This is an absolutely wild technology. It's been around for a number of years now. The ramifications of this technology are so broad that we could spend easily a couple sessions just talking about the potential halachic ramifications and secular ethical ramifications using this technology. How does it work? You can take the sperm and the egg, fertilize it in the laboratory, which Dr. Weiss talked to you about assisted reproduction. And at the 8-cell stage, which is called the blastocyst, this is a pipette. This is the blastocyst. This is the pipette extracting one cell from the blastocyst, and this is almost the complete extraction. So you have an 8-cell embryo, you pull out one of those cells, and you can send that cell to the laboratory for genetic diagnosis. Now this is already been supplanted by more advanced technologies, but this is the basic principle. You have an embryo in the laboratory, you can pull out some genetic material and test anything you want to know genetically about that embryo. In our context, the context is Tay-Sachs, so you can actually find out if this very embryo is afflicted with Tay-Sachs or not, and then you can make a decision not to implant that embryo. So the ramifications for this are huge. What are you going to use it for? You can use it for something as simple as determining gender, if you want to have a boy or a girl. So in the halachic discussions, for example, let's say you have a family has 10 boys and they want to implant a missile for a boo, you can use PGD to have a girl. Let's say you have you want to have a sports kid with more athleticism than your previous children. Let's say you want to have a certain height. Let's say you want to have a certain eye color. Let's say a certain intellectual predisposition. Basically, whatever is genetically testable is potentially testable in these embryos. This is a very interesting case. Women read these books more than the men do, but I don't know if you heard of this book, Jody Picoult's My Sister's Keeper. They actually made a movie out of it.
Yeah, it's a movie.
So you guys probably saw the movie, right? The book you didn't read, but you probably saw the movie. But this is another fascinating application of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, just to tell you where the technology is at. And this is not science fiction, this is real. This is a case of a child who had a particular condition, we'll say it's a certain anemia called the Fanconi's anemia, which is a fatal anemia. And to share with you how the technology has evolved over the decades, like about 25 years ago, there was a family who had a child with this similar condition, and the treatment is bone marrow biopsy. It's bone marrow transplant. So they put the kid on the bone marrow transplant list. There were no matches the world over. So the family conceived a child naturally, and there's a 1 in 4 chance that that child would be, it's called an HLA match, would be able to be a bone marrow donor to that existing child. And as Ashkacha would have it, this is not science fiction, this is a real case, they produced a child who had that exact HLA match, and that child served as a bone marrow donor for the existing child and cured that existing child who's still alive today. Fast forward to the 21st century, you don't have to take a 1 in 4 chance anymore. Now you can send the sperm and egg to the laboratory, produce these fertilized eggs, find the exact egg that's an HLA match, and there's been other technology which is advanced too. You take that egg, you implant it into the woman. In the delivery room, you pull out stem cells from the umbilical cord, and you use those stem cells to reproduce an entire blood system in the child and cure the child. And this has been done. This is not science fiction. So in these cases, it's called a savior sibling. They literally create a child who will be an exact match to an existing child. It's called a savior sibling. In post, we talk about this case of savior sibling too. So Avram and Sarah wanted to do this. They said, well, we do this for our next child so we don't have to worry about the possibility of producing a child with Tay-Sachs. So what are the halachic issues? So you guys, unfortunately, already had a discussion by Dr. Weiss about some of the halachic issues, about Hotzah Zera and Sakona and all these kinds of issues. And in general, post-scheme will allow certain things for a couple to be Mekayim pro revu, right? But this couple has no problem being Mekayim pro revu. They're not infertile. They're capable of having children in a natural way. The only issue with them is there's a concern they might have a child with a disability, with a serious disease. Are you allowed to go through this whole process just to prevent the birth of such a child? So the short answer is, this is from Nishmas Avraham, which I suspect you guys have come across, at least in this course. Other quotes of Shlomo Zalman and Rabbi Yashu and others, that they did allow pre-implantation genetic diagnosis for certain types of scenarios. And in our case of Avraham and Sarah, they got had to undergo PGD, and they had PGD and had a first time they gave birth to a boy, this time they gave birth to a girl, and we're kind of in the midst of approval. Yes?
How many times are you able to do that, though? Once you, like, attempt one girl, then is it...
You can do PGD for every pregnancy.
No, I'm saying, hold up, once you have a who...
Good. So post-cum will differ. If the couple has already been kind of misapproved, they may not allow you to do this technology. And there, by the way, there are couples, you know, especially in the Haredi community, where they have, you know, many, many children, 9, 10, 11, 12, 15 children, who will go to the reproductive endocrinologist after they have 6 or 7 children, they stopped having children, and they want to have more children. So depending on the post-cum, many post-cum will not allow them to avail themselves of this technology if they've already been with kind of the mitzvah approval.
What happens when you get the green light? You just implant the embryo in the back of the woman and pregnancy continues?
Correct. So if you get the green light, you harvest the reproductive seed from the man and the woman, you fertilize it in the laboratory, you do PGD on the embryos, and the embryos that you find don't have whatever condition you're testing for, you can implant those. So then the shaila is, what do you do with the embryos in the laboratory? Do you let them decompose? Is there an iser ritzicha for those? You know, what's the halachic status of embryos? So the short answer to that is embryos don't have a status of a nefesh, and there's no issue with tzicha for those. Yeah.
Even if it, let's say, was a fetus particle, by not... Even was it a fetus?
Yeah.
By not, like, feeding whatever, it's not tzicha. Like, I personally have been letting kill by, like, an animal, it's not tzicha.
Oh, right, so Shei Bel Tassa, if you allow them to decompose. Even if you say they're nefesh, you know, there's no issur with tzicha to let them decompose. But it may not be mutter to do. So in those cases, there's no chiv based in. There's no misas based in, but it's still usher to do. You get karetz. You get, it's usher b'day shemayim. So those people, so the Rambam says, you know, you tie the person on the train tracks. Obviously, the Rambam didn't have train tracks, but you tie him in front of a lion, and the lion eats him. You know, you're not chayav mises bezdin, but it's an isser, and the Kadosh Baruch Hu is going to exact the punishment from you. So I don't think it's mutter to do. It's just technically not punishable, but it's clearly usher to do. So moving along with our family of Avraham and Sarah. So Avraham and Sarah, Sarah gets a phone call from her mother one day, and she says, "I want you to know everything's okay, but I just have to tell you, the doctor just diagnosed me with breast cancer." And they caught it early, and Yirtzeh Hashem is going to be a full cure, and everything's going to be fine. So Sarah tells her mother, said, "Listen, you know, I've been reading the newspapers. There's this gene associated with breast cancer. Maybe you should test for the gene." So her mother says, "Listen, I'm older. I'm not interested in doing any testing. You know, I have the condition. Just leave me alone. If you want to test, you can go ahead and test, but I'm not testing." So what is this? What is this gene associated with breast cancer? You guys heard of the BRCA gene, the breast cancer gene? Anybody familiar with that? So this is a gene that's associated with breast cancer. Just a few very basic facts. I am not a tremendous bucky in this, and it is a complex field. Not everybody who has breast cancer has a genetic form of breast cancer. In fact, the overwhelming majority of breast cancer that is developed by women is spontaneous mutations not associated with a genetic condition. There's a small percentage of people who develop this condition who have the genetic cause. Usually the people who have genetic forms of breast cancer develop it earlier in life. Usually it's a pretty severe form. So the question is there a reason for Sarah to test herself to see if she has this gene, which means maybe her mother had the gene, and that's why she developed breast cancer. Maybe her mother transmitted that gene to her. This gene is not only associated with breast cancer, associated with other cancer. It's not only transmitted to women, it's also transmitted to men. Men can develop breast cancer as well. Men can develop prostate cancer, pancreatic cancer associated with this BRCA gene. So should she test, should she not test? If she tests, what should she do? So there's lots of different things that that can be discussed with this. I'm just going to share with you a few of them. Is there a chiyuv to test? So one could make an argument, especially with a family history, that there may indeed be a chiyuv to test, maybe an obligation to test. Although, to be honest, if you have a family history, your obligation to be vigilant about the disease is the same, whether you have the gene or you don't have the gene. But the importance is, like anything, in health, menishmartim ol nafsho seichem, if you can prevent a disease, you have an obligation to prevent a disease. So if you know you have this gene, that means you're doing mammograms much more frequently, or you're not maybe just doing mammograms, you're also doing maybe ultrasounds and MRIs of that area. Your father is a radiologist who's involved in these kinds of exactly these kinds of things. So it may indeed be a chiyuv to test. Hold for just 1 second. And if she tests and is found positive, then what does she do? Does she just increase her testing, or does she do something more radical than that? Does she do? I don't know if you guys heard, but I assume you've heard of the actress Angelina Jolie. So at least some of you have heard of Angelina Jolie. She's not only famous as an actress in Hollywood; she's also famous because she had the breast cancer gene. And what she decided to do is she decided to remove all the breast tissue. Famous, beautiful actress decided to do a very disfiguring operation to her body, because she lost her mother and her aunt to breast cancer. And she said, this isn't happening to me. I don't care about Hollywood. I don't care about these things. I'm going to do this. So we're not going to debate here whether that's the appropriate medical thing to do. It may be, it may not be. You may not have to do that. Even, by the way, bilateral mastectomy doesn't 100% prevent you, but it obviously significantly decreases. And then not only did she do that, 2 years later, she had her ovaries removed. Because the BRCA gene is not only associated with breast cancer, it's associated with ovarian cancer. Now, so shilas that relate to the surgeries include, are you obligated to do it because maybe you've been nishmarta ma'od, or maybe it's a risk, maybe you shouldn't do it. So those are issues related to the breast surgery, but if you're having ovarian surgery, that's a whole nother halachic discussion. If you have a woman who hasn't had any children yet, should she be taking out her ovaries? If she takes out her ovaries, she can't have any children. She can't be mekayem the mitzvah peruvu. Maybe she should try and have children first, and then after she has children, then she should remove the ovaries. But does that increase her risk of cancer? The longer she waits, the longer the likelihood that she might actually develop cancer. There are no absolute clear answers to these questions. These are very difficult questions that need to be discussed with doctor and posek alike. But my objective is to share with you some of these issues. And another thing, if you find out you're positive and someone finds out that do you have to test your children? And if you test your, should you test your children? Should you not test your children? When should you test them? And if you find out you're positive, so we talked about Tay-Sachs disease and disclosure and knowing or not knowing. If somebody knows that they are BRCA positive, should they inform a potential spouse? So if you're dating somebody who knows that she's BRCA positive, would you like to know that information before you continue dating? So there are interesting halachic shilas about that. So it's a very complex, I generally believe, and I think most people advocate about the community isn't all on the same page, that women shouldn't even be testing for this until there's something you can do about it. And until the age of roughly 26, there's literally nothing you can do medically, even if you're found to have a BRCA. There's no reason to test a 10-year-old for BRCA gene or a 15-year-old, even a 20-year-old. Yes.
Well, this goes back to the whole point of Dor Yashar, is that they don't want people to know things because, let's say you have a girl and she's welcome and you test her. She's 19 and you test her and she's positive. How is this woman going to go about? It brings
right,
up
so
many other shilas that don't need to be.
Excellent. But there is a key difference. Key difference is in Dor Yasharim, the knowledge of your being a carrier has no impact on your life. It simply will affect people who don't understand genetics and will think that you maybe have a pagan, but you don't. In the BRCA situation, if a woman has the BRCA gene, she has an increased risk of breast cancer. Now, this is the difference, which I apologize for not hastening to add before. If a child has two recessive genes of Tay-Sachs, and they are born with that, they will absolutely have the disease.
the presence of this BRCA gene doesn't tell you this person has disease. It's a predisposition gene, which means that if you have this gene, it's a higher likelihood you will develop cancer. It is not 100%, and it doesn't mean that you have the disease. You may never develop the disease. If you test early and frequently, you may find it early and be cured of disease. There may be a cure for the disease by the time you get old enough for it to be relevant. So it's very different than saying, I have a gene for a particular disease. It's a gene which tells you this person has a predisposition. Now, the interesting halachic shaila is, should you use pre-implantation genetic diagnosis for PGD? I mean, for BRCA gene. And it's not so partial, because a person who has the breast cancer gene could live an entire healthy life. And if you're preventing the birth of that individual, who knows what that person could have accomplished in their lifetime with no suffering at all, never would have ever developed the disease.
The Havamines don't fit.
I'm sorry?
The Havamines to do PGD for the Tay-Sachs
doesn't necessarily carry over.
Based on what you just said, if it's
right,
only
but
a
at
free...
the same time, if you were to ask Angelina Jolie, and I know she's got all these adopted children, I don't know if she has any natural children or not, but if you were to ask Angelina Jolie if she would undergo PGD for her child so that the child won't have the BRCA gene, you bet she would. And there are poskim that allow it, but not all poskim allow it. It's not a simple thing. And here's an interesting thought experiment, which it applies only to dominant genes and not to recessive genes. If you were to take all the people in the world, all the Jews in the world that had the BRCA gene, and all of them underwent pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, in one generation you eliminate the BRCA gene from the Jewish population. You have that? I'm not saying, I'm not advising to do that necessarily, but it's just an interesting interesting thought. I'm sorry?
That's it,
because they won't have it, their children, no one's right. Gonna have it anymore. It's gone, finished. These are disclosure issues. I just want to go ahead and see whether we can finish today and whether we don't. This line. So she now, Abraham and Sarah now gets an interesting phone call from a friend of hers. Her friend had some surgery and had her ovaries removed. I'm sorry, had her uterus removed. Her friend had her uterus removed. And she has ovaries. She's married. She's healthy. She has ovaries, so she has eggs to produce a child. But for medical reasons, she had to have her womb. She had to have her uterus removed. So she calls her friend, her close friend, Sarah, and says, I know this is quite a crazy question to ask you, Sarah, but you're already married, you already have children. Would you be my surrogate? What does that mean?
Carry the baby.
Would you carry my baby for me? Would you carry my baby for me? So this is quite a serious thing. This isn't, you know, going shopping or you know making a kugel for somebody. This is 9 months of carrying somebody's baby. So what are the halachic issues that relate to this? And this is a fascinating development in the 20th and the 21st century. And the real shaila is, in these cases, if one person donates the genetics and one person donates the womb, two separate people. Which one is considered the halachic mother? Is it the genetic mother? Or is it the birth mother or the gestational mother, as it's called? And there's some serious halachic issues in the kibbutz of Peru, kibbutz Aim, who's the mother that you're honoring? A very important child, if one is Jewish and one is not. So let's say you have a Jewish couple and they hire a non-Jewish surrogate to carry the child. Or they can carry a child, but she doesn't have any eggs, and they get an egg donor who's not Jewish. Does the child need a giur? Does the child need a conversion or not? Is the child halachically Jewish? This is not fictional stuff. This is not stuff which you don't see. This is halacha l'maisa almost b'chol yom today. There's Jewish couples across the globe that are availing themselves of all these different technologies, and it's important for us to know this. Who do you give a card to on Mother's Day? Very important halachic shaila. Hallmark says you give a card to both mothers. And this one, you're likely to see this ad in the newspaper sometime soon. If I can change this line. I was reformed as an embryo, conservative as a fetus, and orthodox from birth. Seeking same.
So I'm just going to whip through a couple of these makoros to talk about the surrogacy. Yes.
Seems like way too many issues to even consider it. I think.
It seems like way too many issues to get involved in this.
Yeah.
And there's some posts who are averse because of that, because of the complexity, because of the issues of the Jewish, the non-Jewish, who's the Yichus, the Yerusha. But if you are a couple that is unable to have a child, you will do absolutely everything in your power to have a child. You know, you don't have any hasada, you should never, and a bracha, you should never have any hasada of these things. But the desire of the world to have a child, especially in the Jewish community, is so, and it's so pervasive. I mean, Puravu is the first mitzvah in the Torah, that people are willing to do absolutely anything. When the technology is available, people will avail themselves of this technology, and we have to do it with discussion with Christian. Yeah, I think in the interest of time, I'm going to save this maybe for another time. There is no consensus about who's considered the halachic mother. There are those who hold that there's no halachic mother involved because the process is done outside the womb. That's the tzitz Eliezer. There are those who hold the genetic mother is the mother. Some hold the birth mother is the mother. Others hold that both mothers are the halachic mother. Either l'chatchila both mothers are the halachic mother, or just misafek. We just don't know. And since we don't know, we have to go in a fill of chumrah on both. There's another aspect of genetics. And that's population genetics, which I'm just going to mention peripherally. Population genetics is the idea that you can look at genetics and determine somebody's origin. Now, how many times have you seen a commercial like this? You know, I thought I was Irish, and then I sent my DNA to so-and-so, and I find out that I'm Native American. You know, these are the kinds of commercials you're seeing pretty frequently on TV today. So what does this mean? Where is this coming from? What's the science behind this? Is there validity to the science behind this? Is there any halachic impact of this kind of science? So I am not a population geneticist. What they do is they analyze different strands of DNA, different sequences of DNA, and find that commonality tracing its way back through history. Some of it based on actual analysis of populations, some of it based on mathematical extrapolation or reverse extrapolation about what could have been in the past. It is believed to be a real science. It's not believed to be one of these pseudosciences. There are people who are studying the Jewish population and have found commonality in the Jewish genome that spreads across time and place. The question is if you're found to carry these genes, let's say you have a non-Jewish woman who sends away one of these cheek swabs and says, you know, you're 100% Jewish based on the genes, does that mean she's halachically Jewish or not? So the answer to that is no. But there is another test which I'll share with you hopefully for a time, where the answer may actually be yes from a genetic test. And it's quite remarkable. So how do you determine Jewishness? You don't determine Jewishness by genetics. What's the obvious reason you can't determine Jewishness by genetics?
I got my guilt trip.
What do you say? Right. What's that sort of a negative reason? What's a positive reason?
Halacha is simply if someone's mother is Jewish, they're Jewish.
Right. But why can't we use genetics to determine Jewishness? Because we accept gamer. If we accept Gerim, then genetics is a non-starter. Gerim don't have any of the genetics from their previous predecessors, yet they're considered 100% halachically Jewish, and they can marry Jewish and have progeny that's Jewish, etc., etc. Then already he has a significant impact. But the other aspect is that we are in the Orthodox world, and unfortunately the conservative and reformed have changed this over the last few decades. We believe in what's called natural lineal descent, and if your mother is Jewish, you are Jewish. So only one whose mother is a Jew. This is just a mucker for that. And conversion, somebody that undergoes conversion can be Jewish. And a chazaka. This is one of our Blythe's articles about the black Jews, the Ethiopian Jews, when they imported all these Ethiopian Jews. There is a notion of chazaka that if a person has been practicing their Judaism for a number of generations, that they are halachically Jewish, you don't have to investigate any further. So So if they've been Shomer Shabbos, Shomer Kashrus, and the lighting candles, etc., and you know, participate in all Jewish activities, then there's a chazaka that they are in fact Jewish. Some other aspects of genetics for the last few minutes. How many people here have heard of the Cohen gene? You guys heard of the Cohen gene? So the Cohen gene was discovered in the following way. There's a fellow by the name of Professor Skorecki, who's in both in Canada and in Haifa, in Toronto and Haifa, and he, I believe, is a Cohen, and he works with genetics. He's a geneticist and a scientist, and one day, after he got the Aliyah, he said, you know, it just occurred to me that, you know, Cohen is a... the yichus of Kohen, the lineage, is passed down from father to son, father to son. So I wonder if there's any genetic marker that we can possibly find, which is common in all the Kohanim. So he set about to test as many Kohanim as he could across the gamut of Ashkenazim, Sephardim, across the globe. And if you're sitting down to devise an experiment or you want to capture as many Kohanim from different places as possible, where in the world would you do that?
Kotel.
So you do that at the Kotel and Chol HaMoed. You guys ever been to Birchas Kohanim at the Kotel Chol HaMoed? Thousands of Kohanim there. So they set up a station over there, cheek swab station, and they obviously didn't get all of them, but they got a lot of Kohanim over there. And he identified a cluster of genes. He was looking in the Y chromosome. Why was he looking in the Y chromosome? Because that's the paternally transmitted chromosome. So he found in the Y chromosome that there's certain commonality of genes that was more common in these Kohanim as opposed to non-Kohanim. It turned out that it was also common in some other populations that they didn't expect. So there's this tribe in Africa, the black Africans called the Lemba tribe, found out to have a very high prevalence of these Cohen modal haplotype, this Cohen gene. So it's a very interesting research. What are the halachic ramifications of this research? Do you need to have a cheek swab at the bima if you're a gabbai to make sure that these guys are Kohanim or not? The answer to that is no. By the way, Kohanim today aren't Kohanim Kohen Muchzuk, they're not Kohen Vada. Because of the bilbul, who's mentioning that the things have been messed up over the generations? You don't know who's been a chalal over the generations. You don't know who married somebody. You don't even know, by the way, you could have the Kohen gene and your mother could be non-Jewish. So you could even be a goy and have the Kohen gene, a goy gomor and have the Kohen gene, because it's transmitted through the Y chromosome through the man. So it doesn't really help you that much. Could it be helpful, for example? So I think the reason the Cohen gene is being introduced, and this is my hope, is that maybe in the Yemos Mashiach and the Binyan Bayis Shlishi, you know, you have to verify who's a Cohen, who's not, to do the Avoda. So Cohen Chazaka, Cohen is not allowed to do the Avoda. He has to have the Yichus all the way back to Cohen Vada. So maybe the Y chromosome will become more definitive and maybe be able to determine that, but that's not the way it is now. Yeah.
Who are they fooling anyway? The Chayav Misa on the spot, they just go off.
Right, that's true.
Who are you trying to fool at that point?
That is true. So could a Cohen, for example, carrying on our impact in the 21st century, let's say you had a guy today who's a Cohen and he falls in love with Grusha. So could he say, you know, maybe I'm not really a Cohen. Why don't I go test myself and see if I have this special Cohen gene? If I don't have the Cohen gene, maybe I can marry the Grusha or not. So that you absolutely cannot do today.
Does it work vice versa?
Yeah, what do you mean by that?
If you want to marry a Grusha and you send in your testing and you find out you're not a Cohen,
right?
That you have the Cohen gene.
Does it make you a Cohen?
Are you supposed to not marry this person?
No, meaning it doesn't impact your ability to marry this person. It might have an impact, by the way, in theory, on Pidyon HaBen. Same question. Let's say it's someone who wants to, save themselves $5, and says, I've been a Yisrael, but maybe I'm really a Kohen, and if I'm a Kohen, I don't have to pay, five sloim to the Kohen for Pidyon HaBen, so I'm going to test myself to Y chromosome. Or you have someone who's a Yisrael, I'm sorry, it was a Kohen, and then finds out that they don't have the Y chromosome gene, are they now mechuyev to have the pidyon ben for their child? So the answer to all these is no. It has no real halachic relevance today. But for the last few minutes before we break, I want to share with you another very interesting technology, and that is and development of genetic understanding in the last few years, and that's mitochondrial DNA. Now, we talked about the Y chromosome as being paternally transmitted. Mitochondrial DNA, now, for those of you who, you guys all must have had to take biology, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you learned biology, there's DNA in the nucleus, and then you all know your mitochondria, you know, one of the organelles in the cytoplasm. Mm-hmm. Mitochondria also contains a very small percentage of DNA. Sometimes those mitochondrial DNA can have defects in them, and they can wreak havoc on the fetus. These mitochondrial DNA are exclusively transmitted from the mother. They're only found in the cytoplasm of the egg. They're not found in the sperm. So what can you do to remedy this? Today you can do what's called mitochondrial transfer. It's a crazy thing, but it's actually being done. It's very, very early in this technology, and only a handful, if that many, cases have been done. So you take the egg of a woman who has a defect in her mitochondrial DNA, you pull out her nucleus, you take the egg of woman B, who has healthy mitochondrial DNA, pull out her nucleus, and replace it with the nucleus of woman A. So now you have an egg which is a composite of the nuclear DNA of woman A and the mitochondrial DNA of woman B. And then you fertilize that with the zera of the man. So you have a three genetic parent embryo. And we talked about who's considered the halachic mother of a child. Is it the genetic mother or is it the gestational mother? Even those who hold the genetic mother, they would have the shaila, is it now the nuclear DNA mother or is it the mitochondrial DNA mother? That's the shaila that they have. But let me ask you this question. This is a fascinating halachic shaila. They've used mitochondrial DNA in a crazy way. I don't know how familiar you guys are with British history, but Richard III. You guys know who Richard III is? Did you read Shakespeare, Richard III, any of you? What'd you say?
Yeah.
You read Richard III? So Richard III, he's the hunchback. Richard III is the hunchback king. What'd you say? He was not a good king. They didn't even give him a proper burial. So if you go to England and you go to Westminster Abbey, you go to all these places, you see where all these kings are buried. Nobody knows where Richard III was buried because they didn't like him. So they just left him to rot somewhere. So someone did this amazing research, archaeological research, and they found this church that was in archaeological ruins underneath a parking lot in a city in England. And they found what they believed to be was the body of Richard III. And it actually had a hunchback, and he actually had trauma to the skull, which is consistent with the way he died in battle. But they wanted to prove it definitively. So how are you going to prove it definitively? You do a genetic test. So what did they look for? They looked for the mitochondrial DNA in this skeleton, and they have to find a living relative from the times of Richard III to test the mitochondrial DNA. That relative would have to be a Bas Achar Bas from the time of Henry III until today. And they did genealogical research, and they identified two people. And they found that it was almost 100% match in the mitochondrial DNA between these two people and the skeleton they found underground. And they exhumed the skeleton, they gave it like another burial, hope that's anything. Here's my shiloh for you guys in terms of genetics in the 21st century. Let's say, you know, I don't want to say you guys, Rahman son shouldn't happen, but let's say, you know, you have this couple and their son comes back from college and he says, you know, I found this girl, she's great. So I got good news and bad news. You know, good news is I found a girl, the bad news is she's not Jewish. But she sent her genetics testing to one of these places, and they found that she has the mitochondrial DNA of some Jewish woman from 100 years ago. And it's an exact match. Now, from a genetic perspective, and it's not always 100%, so this is a hypothetical. From a genetic perspective, mitochondrial DNA is passed from mother to daughter, mother to daughter, mother to daughter. So if this woman alive today has the mitochondrial DNA of a from Jewish woman from 100 years ago, genetically, she is 100% Jewish. There's no question about it. The question is from a halachic perspective. Can she now take her cross off and put on a Jewish star? And does she go from instead of going to church tomorrow, she's going to shul tomorrow? Does she instantaneously become Jewish because of this realization that she is halachically Jewish, or does she need a giur? That's an interesting shot.
She probably doesn't need a giur at all.
So you think she doesn't need a giur?
No, definitely not. If all that evidence is true, it's based on the whole rich of the third.
So
thing,
there, so this is also, the question is, what is halachic evidence? Do you need edus? Do you need this? We didn't even talk about other aspects of genetics. For example, DNA, when they found the DNA of these people in the World Trade Center, there were about 11 or 12 cases of people who, Rahman al-Islam, died in the World Trade Center accident that had wives that would have been potential agunos. And they had to determine whether the husbands were halachically dead in order for these women to remarry. And in some of them, the only evidence they had was DNA. Now, in halacha, DNA is not edus. Now, DNA, obviously, you ask a scientist, it's one in a billion chance that it could be somebody else, but it's not edus. So can you accept DNA or can you not accept DNA in the halachic world? And the answer is, it's getting late, you guys got to get down there. The answer is, it depends on what you're using the DNA for. So there will be cases where DNA is acceptable in a halachic court. There will be cases where it's not. So in Mamzerus, for example, poskim do not accept DNA because the halacha is, you work very hard to try and minimize Mamzerim in this world. You're not looking for a reason to make a Mamzer. But for Agunos, they consider it maybe a Simon Muvak, and some people would be Matur and Aguna maybe based on DNA. So it's much, much more discussed. So in any case, we had an opportunity to give you at least a taste of the world of genetics. As you can see, it's a very complex world. But Mir Sashemba will give you a little appreciation that you shouldn't have to deal with many of these issues, but if you do or family members do, at least you'll have an idea what it's all about.